And this is one of those topics, which is the clothing that Christians wear. What are Christians supposed to wear? And I'm sure I could have come up with a more clever title. I'm fully aware of that. But I decided to go away from the flashy, kind of like our clothes, but we'll notice that here in a few moments. When we talk about clothes, really the first place we go to, or many people go to, is going to be 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. And it says, I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands, without wrath and doubting. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, when we start to talk about modest apparel, by way of introduction, I think there's two extreme views when it comes to modesty. The first that you'll probably hear, and I feel like we have brethren on both sides of this, I truly believe that both sides are harmful, both sides are wrong. So the first side you'll probably hear is that modest apparel is the bedrock of Christian theology. You know, maybe we have a Bible study with somebody about, you know, other things, like maybe Jesus or the church or something like that. But then the next one has to be, oh, don't you know about modest apparel? You better be wearing modest apparel or otherwise you're doomed to hell. It's the bedrock of everything that we believe is important. It's the one thing that separates us from the rest of the world. Now, that's one extreme. And then there's other people that look at this as extreme and they say, well, I don't particularly like that extreme. So they go to, let's never address it and just be happy that people are covered up at all. You know, that's a pretty good system too. You know, as long as people are wearing some kind of clothes and they're not running around naked, then really that's the Christian standard is what some people will say. Both approaches are wrong. No, modest apparel is not the be-all, end-all of the Christian faith. But nor is it an issue that doesn't matter. We need to be somewhere in the middle on this and treat it with some grace and mercy, yes, but also with some seriousness and with a level of importance. When we discuss what Christians are supposed to wear, God has not left us without guidance on this. He's not left us to wander around in the dark, figuring out what might fit best, if you will. But no, He's given us a list of principles to follow, but He hasn't given us a list of specific clothing, and that might be a problem for some people. Because one of the more common arguments that you will hear, there's an old argument that did state that God did specify a type of clothing that women specifically were supposed to wear by using the Greek word for apparel here in 1 Timothy 2 verse 9, which is katastole. And according to Thayer, which is an old Greek lexicon, it meant a garment let down. And from that, there were many people that insisted that a garment let down had to mean a dress or a skirt. And thus, they said that God was specifying, by using this particular word, katastole, that this is what women were to wear. Now, there's a few arguments with this, or a few problems with this, that we want to address here this morning. Because, like sometimes happens, it's not that it came to necessarily a bad conclusion. It might have come to a good conclusion the wrong way. And that's sometimes how things work. Sometimes we really believe strongly in something, but the way we come about that conclusion is using the wrong hermeneutic. And I think this is the same, the problem here. The first problem is that this is a compound word. It comes from the word kata in the front and then stole in the back. And a problem is that a compound word doesn't always equal the two parts of it. A good example of this would be a butterfly. Now, when we say butterfly, we don't mean butter and a fly put together equals a butterfly. We're not talking about flying dairy products. What we mean is not the sum of two parts. And likewise, to say that the sum of two parts of any word equals its whole is not really a good argument. There's some problems with that. A second problem is that the word kata itself doesn't just mean down. So stole means garment. Kata in classical Greek, which is what Thayer was primarily referencing, which came before Koine Greek, which is what the New Testament was written in some 500 or 600 years before, it may have meant down there, but kata actually has a fairly wide semantic range, which is what leads the Theological Dictionary of New Testament Words to say that it's hard to say whether katastole here means demeanor or clothing, because really the idea is not down in direction so much as subdued. So there's actually a verb form of this, which is katastello. And this is talked about, I believe, in Acts chapter, in the book of Acts, to talk about subduing a mob or subduing a crowd. So to say that kata just means down in direction is not very good as far as an argument goes. And the third is that this word, katastole, is only used here in the New Testament scriptures. And it's rarely even used in Greek literature. I looked it up. There's maybe one other place, or two possibly, in other Greek works. But it's very rarely used. This is what we call a hapax legomena, meaning a word only used one time in scripture. So to just say that, well, obviously this means a garment let down, is kind of, it's not fair. If it's only used once, a lot of times we need more information in order to make such a statement. So, this is a classic example, I say, of coming to a good conclusion using a bad reason or a bad method, a bad hermeneutic. The better method is not quite as clear-cut as this. Now, let's remember that while this may make some Christians nervous, that you can't just look at this word and say, well, obviously this is what we have to wear, or a specific dress code, because we often like our answers clear-cut. We don't like to wander around in the dark, and if it's at all possible, we like to turn our brains off and just follow a list of rules and not really think about it at all. But actually, this is a very good thing that it's not a clear-cut thing, because the wonderful thing about the Bible and God's will is that it transcends time and culture. It transcends cultural norms and barriers. It transcends trends. It transcends pop culture. So as opposed to God handing out an official dress code for everyone, if you're baptized into Christ, for example, now you have to wear a straw hat and overalls and sandals from here out to eternity. He could have said that. And as opposed to God demanding a dress code that might be offensive to some societies or completely foreign to them, something they would have never heard of or seen before, God instead provides his people with timeless commands. He provides them with principles that can be obeyed at any time, place, and culture on earth. How could Christianity ever hope to be cohesive if it demanded the inculcating of very specific and often very dated cultural practices? The unity of the Church of Christ necessitates that anyone anywhere can be added to the church and be able to follow the simplicity of the pattern regardless of outside factors. I think we see this in Galatians 3:27. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So the journey that we are about ready to embark on here this morning is what we're going to call principal teaching. We're teaching this topic not based off of a specific thou shalt or thou shalt not command, but understanding how to live out God's principles for Christian living in the absence of a thou shalt not command. And there's quite a few of these, actually. It's important for any abstract concept that we consider that we must apply practically. We're told that we have to love one another. How do we express that? Well, we're not given a list of exactly how to express that in every single circumstance, but the significant thing is that the absence of it is quite clear. There is a level of maturity and wisdom that a person has to have in order to properly obey a principle. But when that principle is absent from a person's life, you can see it very, very clearly. Love looks differently in some places and some circumstances, but you can tell when it's missing. And so too are some of the more abstract principles of Christianity, like what we wear. As we apply them practically, there will be variations. But when the principle is absent, it is obvious to all. So let us also remember that a principle ignored is no different than a command that is broken. Our understanding of Christian living cannot be limited to only what God has explicitly made a command about. God expects us to use our brain. He expects us to have a level of understanding and a level of discernment in order to live in this world. And I think He's at times given us maybe a little bit too much credit in that. But He's given us the credit regardless. And that's something that we should not take lightly. Principle ignored is a command broken. And there are some things that we can do, even though maybe there's not an explicit command about it. For example, therefore to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. If there is something that you know is good and know is right according to the will of God, a principle, if you will, and you choose not to do it, whatever that good might be, I believe this verse calls that a sin. Our topic is going to talk about the clothing of Christians. And we're going to talk about it for both men and women. What are the principles given on what we can wear? And how do the principles in the Bible translate to the modern fashions 2,000 years removed from this passage? The first principle that we're going to notice here is that of covering nakedness. Now, this is very simple. I think most of us will agree here. In fact, good job, everybody. I think we're doing that here this morning. We're covering nakedness, meaning that my clothing needs to make sure that I'm not exposing myself. This is what we mean when we talk about covering nakedness. And this is a very first principle regarding Christian attire that was established back in the Garden of Eden. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 7, when Adam and Eve sinned, you remember, then the eyes of both of them were open and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. In verse 21, it says, also for Adam and his wife, the Lord made tunics of skin and clothed them. Now, there's a bunch of theological implications here that we're not going to focus on here this morning. But this teaches us a very important first lesson that mankind made clothes for them for himself. And what mankind thought it meant to cover up nakedness was not God's standard. He says, this is not good enough for what I expect you to wear. Christians have to wear clothes that meet God's standards for covering up nakedness. And that's not optional. You'll notice in the Christian world, there's no nudist communities. We don't believe in that. That's not what we do or practice. And if we really start thinking about why mankind needs to wear clothing in the first place, clothing only exists because of sin. I think about this, and I think about it a lot whenever I'm doing laundry. Clothing only exists because of my sin and because of your sin, because we have fallen to the desires that we wanted to do that were against God's word and God's wishes. And this is ultimately what happened with Adam and Eve, of course. Clothes are badges that we wear that remind us of the knowledge of good and evil that we now possess, and that and the sin that we have fallen to over and over again. And because of this, mankind has to cover himself. Well, what needs to be covered, one might say? What constitutes the covering of one's nakedness? Well, again, I think pretty much every person here already knows that answer, but we'll just state it for the benefit of everyone. Pretty much all of us, for all human history, knows that that usually constitutes the chest area, it constitutes the genitalia, it constitutes the rear end, it constitutes the back, it constitutes the midriff, and down to the legs to a certain extent. You'll have a very hard time finding anybody who would say otherwise. Sometimes I think about mom and grandma would sometimes look at, oh, look at that person over there. They're half naked. You ever heard that phrase before? Half naked is not something we want to aspire to either. We want to be fully covered. We want to be not naked. So anything that constitutes in your mind might being half naked should be fully tossed out, if you know what I mean. Now, to what extent does this cover? Isaiah 47 verses 2 and 3 kind of gives us a little bit of an insight here. It says, take the millstones and grind meal, remove your veil, take off the skirt, uncover the thigh. That's interesting. Uncover the thigh, pass through the rivers, your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance. I will not arbitrate with a man. Now, the scripture here identifies that uncovering the thigh, or uncovering the leg is what modern translations have it, is to make bare the leg and thus uncover your nakedness. Now, This is not a measurement that's measured exactly in feet or inches, but it's kind of measured from person to person. Now, is this a hard and fast rule? You be the judge. Should this be a hard and fast rule? To me, this is an excellent guideline. If you want an answer or a place to start, I feel like this is probably going to work out pretty well for you, because it certainly meets the criteria that we just discussed, and it might give someone a little bit extra coverage, a little wiggle room, just in case, for a little peace of mind. Remember, we have to make sure that our nakedness is covered with every activity that we're doing out in public or around other people, even passing through a river, as it turns out, as best that we can. And now we might have to sacrifice doing some activities in order to do that that cannot be done without uncovering your nakedness, or do them differently than what the world tells us that we have to do them as. That might mean that Christians can't be swimsuit models. I know that might tear some of y'all up, but I think that's probably a pretty good standard. I don't think swimsuit models should be something that a Christian aspires to be. Might mean that us guys, whenever we're at the gym or working out or out in the field or whatever, we're not running around shirtless. Might mean that various popular articles of clothing, including many swimsuits, short shorts, some athletic wear, and revealing low-cut tops, aren't going to be part of the Christian's wardrobe. Now, do we find this same principle of covering nakedness in the New Testament? I believe we do. In Revelation 16, verse 15, it says, "Behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." Now, of course, this is a passage that is taking a known physical principle and putting a spiritual meaning upon it. And thus, in order for it to work, the physical principle has to be a known truth to begin with. God demands that Christians cover their nakedness. But that's not all he asks. That is not all he demands. There are some that conflate covering nakedness with dressing modestly, and they are not the same thing. They say, "Well, look, you know, I don't wear a bikini, or I don't walk around without with my shirt off. I don't wear short shorts. That means I'm dressing modestly." No. Actually, making sure your body is covered with clothing is just one principle. Now, there are still others that are very present in the scriptures that govern our clothing options. The next we'll look at is that of sex distinction, gender distinction, meaning my clothing will not resemble the clothing of the opposite sex and will align with my sex. An awful lot said today about sex and gender identity, what it is and where it comes from. I want to remind us from a biblical perspective that gender and sex are not two unrelated things, as some people claim that it is. They are very much connected to each other and are a product of the creation order that God placed at the very beginning. Genesis 1 verse 27 says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." This order is not created by societal inequalities designed to reinforce a patriarchal system to oppress women, but rather by God himself. And notice that this creation order is not designed to make women inferior. It's not designed to put women down, but they are looked at as equal but different. And that's what gender distinction, sex distinction is. It is equal but different. It appears to be this very principle that is at the heart of the prohibition in the law of Moses, which talks about the need for gender distinction between the sexes, and the most obvious and outward manifestation of this creation order, which is Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5, which states plainly, "A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God." Now, why would God actually care about the clothing choices of men and women and them swapping their clothing on each other if there wasn't a moral and ethical principle that was being broken? One can easily see the connections between this prohibition and the positive guiding principle given in Genesis chapter 1 that men and women are different and they were created to be different. Now, there's a few retorts given to using this verse to prove this point. A common one that you'll hear is that the context of this verse, they will say, is talking about things in relation to pagan worship practices. That this is just talking about things that pagans would do, and this is just telling the children of Israel, don't do pagan things. Well, I think this is just blatantly false. This is not the context, particularly of Deuteronomy 22, but this is a common problem that you will see in the liberal, scholarly, biblical world, where people superimpose the culture of pagan nations around Israel at this time period, and they only are listening to the macro cultural context that they lived in. Now, that's important to understand, obviously, but that's not how we do Bible study. We don't take the largest area of context and superimpose it upon the verse in question. We look at the actual context. We look at the verse, and then we look at the verses surrounding it, and then the chapter, and then the book, and then maybe after that we look at the surrounding historical context to give us insight. We work from inside out, not outside to in. This passage happens to appear in a list of miscellaneous laws that have nothing to do with pagan practices, and is followed by laws governing consequences of sexual immorality. So yes, the context is very much talking about everyday life and is not limited to pagan worship practices. Now, someone else might say, and in fact, I was asked this kind of recently, and it got me to thinking a little bit more serious about this. Well, this is an Old Testament verse, you understand. This verse appears in the Old Testament. We don't live in the Old Testament anymore. So how can you expect this principle to be carried over into the New Testament for Christians to listen to and apply? Now, my first reaction was to simply quote Romans 15 verse 4 and say, well, all things written before time were written for our learning. The Old Testament was written for our learning. And that would be true, but I think, and I started to think, you know, that's kind of a cheap cop-out. And I don't think it's one that we need to take, because there's ample proof in the New Testament that supports this principle introduced in Genesis and Deuteronomy, and it remains the standard in the New Testament. Now, I want to notice some things in the New Testament that reinforce this idea of sex distinction, gender distinction. Matthew 19 and verse 4, Jesus himself says, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?" Now, of course, Matthew 19, Jesus is talking about marriage and divorce. But he backs up a little bit further and says that the guiding principle, the fundamental principle behind what I'm about ready to tell you, was established in Genesis chapter 1. It was established from the very beginning. And this model, this establishment, is still God's desire for mankind. He recognizes that male and female still exist. We move forward and we look at Romans chapter 1, verse 26 through 28. I'm going to put the verses up here, and I hope perhaps you all will read them as we go afterwards in your own study on this matter. But Romans chapter 1, verse 26 through 28 talks about sexual distinction design from creation between sexes, understanding that men with men is not natural, and that women with women is not natural. That the natural use of the woman is to be with the man in holy matrimony. That is the natural way. And people with minds that desire to go away from God are breaking this sexual distinction that was designed from creation. We read about this in Romans chapter 1. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9, there are a couple of words used there. One of those, according to the New American Standard, talks about those who are effeminate. In your New King James, it'll say homosexual. Talks about those who are effeminate, and it's referring to men who behave like women in homosexual relationships taking the submissive role. I didn't take a lot of pleasure in writing that sentence, but that is what's going on here. That is what's being described. And I think that's important for us to understand when we're talking about this, stating that such individuals will not inherit the kingdom of God. It's a vivid image, but there's a reason the Bible contains it, because to abandon the natural creation order is to blur lines of sex and gender. And to state that a man can act like a woman or a woman can act like a man in this way is wrong. It is against the creation order. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 2 through 16. It describes, it's talking there about hair. And it's talking about the covering for men and women. And it's showing that there is a distinction of appearance of hair between the sexes. In fact, in verse 15, it talks about how it is a shame for a man to have long hair, but that that even nature itself teaches us this, but that it is a glory for women to have long hair. There is a distinction that takes place between the sexes that is based on not societal norms or the patriarchy, but upon creation order. Now, we've noticed these things, but someone might say, well, yes, gender distinction is real, but what about when it comes to our clothing? Well, let's not forget that 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9 and 10 is specifically addressing women. And it's making distinction between sexes in dress. A lot of times we try to say, well, yeah, modest apparel is important for women, but we try to make it unisex and say, well, yeah, we got to address the men too because we can't just pick on the women. I think there's guiding principles, and I think we're showing that as we go along, that address both men and women. But our primary audience in 1 Timothy 2 verse 9 is to women. It's showing that there is a gender distinction in clothing and in how they adorn themselves that is different in some ways than men. There is some overlap, of course, in principles between men and women, but these instructions are specifically showing women that the way that they dress is supposed to reflect what is proper for women professing godliness with good works. How can we tell the difference between men and women's clothes in our culture? Again, I think we can use a little bit of common sense in that one. It's not as hard as really you might think that it is. Now, I know that it's not that we don't actually know. I think it's sometimes we're trying to act smug, and I think we're trying to push boundaries a little bit. If you really don't know, I suggest maybe ask a drag queen. They've been successfully identifying men and women's clothes for decades now. And if you, as an informed Christian, can't tell, then ask someone who very much does. I say that tongue-in-cheek, because shame on us if we can't tell the difference between men and women's clothes. But there are more principles that male and female Christians need to consider. The next is that of being respectful or showing propriety. And this means, am I making sure that my clothing is proper and that it is not lewd or provocative? Now, this is a very important one. Christian clothing is supposed to be proper and respectful. And this comes from the word eidos here in 1 Timothy 2 verse 9, which according to Lao and Nida, the quality of modesty with the implication of resulting respect or modesty. There's a little bit of overlap in some of these words and the ideas they're portraying, but I think that we can get the idea. The King James Version would translate this word as shamefacedness. There's actually a little bit of truth in that translation, as the antonym of this word, anideia, is one that talks about having shamelessness. The antonym is talking about being shameless, someone who has no shame. We are to have a sense of propriety, of modesty, of decency, of shamefacedness, as opposed to being lewd, shameless, or lascivious. As the old King James is one of my favorite words to say, although the meaning is certainly not one that is very fun. There are several passages that tell Christians they're not to be lewd. They're not to be provocative. Galatians 5 verse 19, now the works of the flesh are evident. They are clearly seen, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, and lewdness. You know it when you see it. It's evident. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, for we've spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness and in lusts and so on and so forth. This isn't talking about dressing to look pretty. It's not talking about dressing handsomely. It's not talking about putting yourself together in the morning and, you know, putting on clothes that match. This is talking about someone that is wearing clothes or participating in acts and behaviors that would invite and encourage sexual thoughts and practices because of what you're accentuating on your body. Now, does the Bible acknowledge that this is something that can be done with clothing? Yeah, I think it does. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 10 says, "And there was a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart." What is the attire of a harlot? I didn't put a picture up here, and I'm not asking you to picture it in your mind. I'm saying it revolves around things that excite sexual desire somehow, in some way. It's not enough just to make sure our nakedness is covered. We've talked about this. And I dare say that something that is... you can wear something that covers your nakedness that is still lewd and lascivious just because it's acceptable to be worn at the gym. Just because it's acceptable for something to be worn at the club does not mean that it's right for a Christian to wear. Clothes that are too tight, including some shirts and pants and leggings, yes, even some dresses and skirts, that accentuate, that are designed to draw sexual attention, they are lewd, they are provocative, and they are the very thing that the Lord tells both men and women not to do. This is not exclusively for women. This is for men and women alike. Now, there are some modern folks that will say that telling someone to not dress lewdly, well, that means that you're trying to suppress them from expressing themselves, and simply because the opposite sex can't control themselves. Others might say that if someone dresses lewdly and is then taken advantage of or raped, that somehow this individual had it coming, or that this individual brought it upon themselves. Now, I strongly disagree with both of these. Both of these are very wrong statements to make. Lewdness of others is not an excuse for us to sin. Just because someone else is being lewd is not an excuse for me or you or anybody else to act upon it, to lust after it, or to fall to sin. We have to control ourselves. That's the number one principle. In fact, it's the only person we can control is ourselves. But also, dressing properly and respectfully doesn't mean that you're hiding or suppressing yourself in a way that's wrong or a way that's unhealthy. In some ways, we do need to suppress ourselves just a little bit, because we are created in the image of God as unique and beautiful image bearers of the Almighty Creator. And that alone has value. That alone has worth and merit. You're not a piece of meat to be ogled and sexualized. No one is. You are worth more than that. And don't sell yourself short or your body short for the short-lived impressions of disgusting, lewd people. Because there are plenty of them out there, and they are not worth your attention. They are not worth your actions or your thoughts. There is a place where God-ordained sexuality can be expressed and enjoyed. And this is not on the street corner, and it's not in the middle of a Target or the Walmart. It's between married people that are committed to one another. That's God's design. And outside of that relationship and design, it is lewdness, it's lasciviousness, and it's not proper, it's not respectful. Who are we respecting with our clothes? We're respecting ourselves. Do I have the self-respect not to put myself out there as a piece of meat for other people to look at? Part of this is self-respect. Part of this is respect for God, saying that I am bearing the image of who my Creator is. And I want to give that the best impression as I possibly can. The last we'll notice here is that of moderation and modesty, meaning I don't wear my clothing to get attention. My clothing is appropriate and it's sensible. Now, the word modest, we often use that as a synecdoche. And what I mean by synecdoche is where you're saying one word that refers to the whole. A lot of times we say, well, you know, men and women should dress modestly. And what we mean, I think, is that we're trying to say that it includes all of these attributes and aspects. But it's important to understand what modesty by itself means, because what modesty is actually talking about doesn't really have anything to do with covering nakedness. It doesn't have to do with gender distinction, and maybe only a little bit about respectful and propriety. While it's not necessarily wrong to use the phrase, I dress modestly, as a synecdoche, we also must understand what specifically is meant by the word modest and by the word moderation that's used here. The Greek words for modest and moderation are these, kosmios, meaning pertaining to being proper or suitable in terms of being attractive, proper or suitable, according to Laonida. And then sophrosyne, to have understanding about practical matters and thus be able to act sensibly, to have sound judgment, to be sensible, to use good sense, sound judgment. This is talking about a thought process that has to take place. Now, do these principles apply to men and women alike? I think they do, because they're specifically principles that have to be in the life of an elder. 1 Timothy 3 verse 2 says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, and of good behavior, hospitable and able to teach. Very interesting. Good behavior, respectable, as the New American Standard says in the NIV, is the same word to describe modest in modest apparel. It's kosmios. Sober-minded for elders is the same root word for moderation. And that should be part of how women are supposed to dress in the chapter previous. Over in 1 Peter chapter 3, and verse 3 through 4, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, and putting on fine apparel, but rather let it be the hidden person of the heart with incorruptible beauty, of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Modesty, when we talk about modesty, modesty is a mindset. Moderation is a mindset. This is how I process things. Literally, this is about as a good example as you get. Sometimes people say, you know, baptism is an outward show of an inward faith. That's not true. Baptism is what now saves us, according to 1 Peter 3:21. What is an outward show of an inward faith is how we dress, or it's one of the things. That change that takes place when we rise to walk in newness of life is made manifest in one way, by the way that we dress and appear to people. What is that change? The change that takes place inwardly is that my goal is not to impress people anymore. It's not to impress people by what I put on the outside or my outward appearance to make people think that I'm good or that I'm special, that I'm set apart, or even that I'm weird and abnormal. There's lots of people that that's become kind of a popular thing, you know. Well, I put this particular shirt on because it looks weird, or it's a weird color, or it stands out in a crowd. My clothing is showing that I am more than what you see on the outside. That my outside is not the most important thing about me. Not that we start dressing like hobos, I'm not advocating for that, but we aren't putting our importance or our value on the outward appearance. Also, that what you're wearing serves a purpose. One thing that I've learned about fashion, not that I know a whole lot, but I have, you know, when you have two sisters and a mother and you hear about fashion, I'll say most of my information is secondhand. But when you start talking about fashion, what I've learned is that most of it is not practical and it's not comfortable. If you have to make life decisions like, you know, I'd like to wear this, but I'm going to be in pain all day, or I'm going to have to keep pulling it down because it's maybe a little bit too short or clingy, or I'm going to be have to be careful about how I sit, or I can't wear it in certain places because I don't want to ruin it, may I suggest that you aren't adorning yourself with moderation and sensibility and good judgment. You're adorning yourself to get the attention of other people. And that's not what Christians do. That's not our goal, is to try to show people on the outside that I'm great or special or worthy of looking at. It's the inward man of the heart, which is very precious in the sight of God. So in conclusion this morning, oh yes, modesty is a mindset. In conclusion, you might be asking me, well, what are we supposed to wear then? You've mentioned these principles. Now provide us with a list of approved and disapproved clothing. Well, that's an answer that you're going to have to come up with, I think. You might ask me the question, can women wear pants? Or can men wear kilts? Here's the real question that we need to ask. Do my clothes abide by all these biblical principles? That's the question. I'm not going to make a blanket statement this morning like women can only wear skirts or dresses, because as it turns out, there are some skirts and dresses that they shouldn't be wearing, that aren't proper, that are lewd and shameless, that aren't modest or in moderation. I'm not going to make a blanket statement also like it's fine for a woman to wear all pants either. Why? Because if we're being honest, they immediately run up against two of the principles that we've discussed. If they're truly women's pants, cut to fit a woman's body, then you will find that nearly all of them are going to be lewd. They are going to be accentuating the body provocatively to elicit sexual desire. You might ask women why they want to wear these types of pants. Universally, I've heard it before, it will be because they make me look good, or they make me feel good. They give me an attention boost, or a boost in my self-confidence and self-worth. We've just described that's not where we get our worth. If they're truly women's pants, then you do have to be careful for that. Conversely, if they aren't cut to fit a woman's body, tell me then what exactly separates them from men's pants? Now, perhaps there is some pair of women's pants that are simultaneously gender distinct and not lewd. I'm perfectly comfortable stating that that is a possibility, but I believe that there would be very few that would fit the criteria, if you will. And that being said, what's really important here, again, is not so much the article of clothing, it's this principle. Check your heart. Check your motives. That's what's going on. Because we're not nearly as objective on this subject as we think we are. And this comes with a warning for us to examine our motives. Why do I want to push the boundaries to make sure? Why do I want to push these boundaries? Are you trying to make sure that you're fitting into a world that doesn't embrace these principles, or that rebels against these principles to prove your own point? May I suggest that your clothing is a manifestation of what's in your heart? If you're thinking about pushing boundaries, well, what can I get away with, you know? He said all that, but you know, there is this one pair of pants, or there is this one skirt, or maybe there is this one shirt. I really like it. It's my favorite in my closet. And maybe if I just think and consider it for a little while and, you know, maybe be real careful how I wash it and dry it, maybe I can just go ahead and wear it. Well, what if I did just go ahead and wear it? What would he say then? What do you think the reaction would be? What's your motive? What are you thinking about in your heart? You're not thinking about how can I best serve God or how can I best serve my brethren. You're thinking about yourself. That doesn't mean there's a problem. If you're thinking about pushing boundaries, if you're thinking about what can I get away with, then the problem isn't with your clothes, there's a problem with your heart. Check your heart. Check your motives. I'd also point out that when we're talking about principle teaching, there's nothing that quite replaces having peace of mind. And for you, that might mean that you create a boundary for yourself. That doesn't mean that you can place this boundary on other people. But if that boundary keeps you in a state of mind where you know I can follow God better, I suggest that you rejoice in that and perhaps even share that with a few other people who might be struggling. There's nothing wrong with placing a boundary upon yourself. Not that you place that upon other people and bind that on other people. But there is something to having peace of mind. What about men wearing kilts? Love this question. That's not true. I hate this question. Because I think it's really stupid. Because for one, I don't live in Scotland. None of us here live in Scotland. I don't know of a single Scot that's here in the audience. And yet that's the question that we ask. Well, what about kilts? I'm not going to wear one. A, because I'm not Scottish, and also, I think it's a joke. And that's the whole point in asking the question, is because here, it's a joke. Over there, it's not. And to me, that falls under the category of being modest in moderation, even before gender distinction. I'm not going to wear one because it's purposely drawing attention to myself that doesn't need to be there. I'm trying to say something about me rather than say something about God. However, there is a sense in which there are cultural norms of what constitutes gender distinction in society. There always has been in every culture, and that's why God's principles are timeless. because these principles can be applied and followed in whatever culture we exist. And I think we do need to acknowledge that. Now, perhaps there are other areas that you might be concerned about in how you dress. Certainly, we didn't address all of them this morning. But be very honest with yourself and remember your ultimate purpose. What's your ultimate purpose? My ultimate purpose is to glorify God. And everything that I say, do, and think, with all of my heart, with all of my soul, with all of my mind, with all of my strength, I'm supposed to love the Lord. That's the goal. That's our purpose. And truthfully, this whole study really isn't even about clothing. We zoom out a little bit. This is about serving God. This is about glorifying Him in all that we do, placing the glory upon Him and not upon me. And if you have a question, if your wardrobe is accomplishing that purpose, then make sure that your heart is right with the Lord.